Okay, let's open our Bibles then together at that passage we read, Luke chapter 22, beginning at verse 63, page 1215. I was somewhat shocked the other day to discover how long we've been in Luke's Gospel. Perhaps some of you aren't as shocked as I was. We began in April 2016, so we've been over 3 years in Luke's Gospel, although there's been some breaks along the way, and I think one sabbatical during that time. But we've been slowly making our way, Sunday morning by Sunday morning, through this Luke's account of the life of Jesus. And now we are coming to the heart of it all, to the climax of Luke's Gospel. To Jesus' suffering and death. This is the event that the whole of the gospel has been moving towards, the whole of the gospel has been anticipating. So Luke has given us an account of Jesus' birth, and we've gone through that together. He's given us an account of his amazing life and all the things that he did. He's told us of some of the miracles that Jesus performed. He's recorded for us some of his amazing wisdom and his teaching. And now we come to his suffering and his death. Jesus, Luke has reminded us, hasn't he, has set his face towards Jerusalem. He knows what's before him. If you just turn back to chapter 18 and verse 31, he said, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and all things which are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man will be accomplished. For he will be delivered to the Gentiles and be mocked and insulted and spit upon, and they will scourge him and kill him. And the third day he will rise again." And now these events that he's predicted are upon him. They've come. He's entered them. And we must watch on, mustn't we? We must look on and look at him. And what do we need to remember this morning as we look at these things? Well, we need to remember this, don't we? That it was for us that he knew them. It was for us that he bore them. He's come for us, hasn't he? The Son of God became the Son of Man so that we might become the children of God. He's become the man of sorrows so that we might know joy and gladness. He's rejected and shamed so that we might know acceptance and honor. He's going to die so that we might have life. We need to remember those things, don't we, as we look at this passage, as we look at Jesus's his suffering. And my prayer is that as we head to the cross, that we might be moved and stirred and love Jesus more and be more determined to deal with sin that caused this more, and to look to him. So we're going to look at this. It's quite a large chunk this morning, and you'll see from the outline there, from the sheet, that we're going to think about two main things. We're going to think about his enemies and the authorities, and we're going to be thinking about their actions and their words and their aims. And then more briefly, we're going to look at Jesus and his actions and words and aim. So that's where we're heading this morning. So let's look, first of all, and think about his enemies and the authorities, and first of all, their actions. What can we say about them as we've read this passage through? Well, first of all, their actions are cruel, aren't they? Verse 63 to 65. This tells us how those who've had Jesus in custody, they've been entrusted with Jesus, they've gone out, they've arrested him, they brought him back. How do they treat him? Well, it says, doesn't it, in verse 63, they mocked him and beat him. That word beat is a very strong word. It can mean to flog, or it can mean to scourge. It implies hard, plain, painful blows, generally with an implement. And the tense here indicates it's ongoing, so it could better be translated, they kept mocking him and they kept beating him. And they make a game out of it, don't they? by blindfolding him so that he doesn't know who the next blow's coming from and where the next blow's coming from. And then they say, prophesy, tell us, who was it? Who did it? Can you tell them, say their name? This man, then, who's done nothing but good, has he? We've led his life. We've watched his life. He's done nothing but good. He's shown nothing but kindness. His hands have healed. His hands have healed the sick. He's spoken words of grace, and yet here's how he's treated. Their actions are cruel. And this is just the beginning, isn't it? Pilate's going to have him flogged. The soldiers are going to have their way with him before he even gets to the cross. What did Isaiah say? He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquity. I mean, we're seeing it here, aren't we? He's being bruised. The swellings are coming up. The wounds are happening. Their actions are cruel. Their actions are dishonorable. Look at verse 66. As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both the chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council. Now, we know from the other Gospels, actually, that they've already met in the night. The council has already met. They've already made their decision. They've already condemned Jesus. But actually, interestingly, in Jewish law, it was illegal for a court to hold session at night. It was illegal for a court to make a sentence at night. And so to give some sort of semblance of lawfulness, they bring him out first thing in the light and do the same thing again. Now, we know they're not interested in the truth. They brought false witnesses in, haven't they, who have been so bad that they've not managed to get their stories together. They haven't even had to be cross-examined, and their whole stories have fallen apart. And in the end, Jesus has to give them something to condemn him with, doesn't he? He has to say, he has to admit that he is the Son of God so that they can accuse him of blasphemy. But they're not interested in the truth, and they're not interested in justice. Again, what a contrast to Jesus, whose words have just been so truthful, haven't they? He's a man of integrity. There's no guile or deceit on his lips at all. There's no twisting of the truth. He speaks with absolute honesty and justice. Their actions are cruel and dishonorable and humiliating, aren't they? Just go down to the last section where he's before Herod. We'll come back to it again. But just notice what they do at the end. They haven't got anything out of him. They haven't got anything against him to put against him. But in verse 11 we read, don't we? Look at it there in verse 11 of chapter 23. Then Herod, with his men of war, how mighty they are, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. The robe is all part of the mockery, isn't it? What do children dress up? You know, let's pretend to be something. Well, that's fine, isn't it? But, well, let's dress Jesus up. He's claiming to be a king. Let's pretend he's a king. And it is at least this in part, isn't it, that unites Herod and Pilate again. They've obviously fallen out over something, but this brings them back together again. They're friends again. Pilate sees the funny side of it. They're united in their humiliation of Jesus. Again, think about it. This is the King of Kings. On the Mount of Transfiguration, you children remember, don't you, what happened? The veil's taken back a little bit, and the glory of Jesus is seen, and Peter and James and John are overwhelmed, and they're terrified. And now Herod and his miserable men are dressing him up and mocking him. Matthew Henry says, they make nothing of the one who made everything. They make nothing. They treat him as nothing, the one who made everything. Well, that's their actions. What about their words? Well, their words are blasphemous, first of all, aren't they? Look at verse 65. And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. I mean, the irony of the whole situation, of course, is that they're accusing him of blasphemy. And yet, their words are full of blasphemy as they mock and speak evil and lie about Jesus Christ. Now, think again, the whole of his life, of course, has been evidence of who he is. I mean, every miracle that he's done in his own authority. Only God could do that. His authority has been seen in his words as well. And then just think about what these very people have not long before seen. I think I mentioned it last time in John's account of the arrest in the garden. You remember when they come and they say, we're after Jesus. Which one's Jesus? And he says, I am he. And you remember what happens? They all fall down to the ground. So these very people have felt his power and his authority. Not only that, they've seen his power and his kindness. Because again, you children, remember what happens? Peter cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest. What does Jesus do? He heals him. A miracle. And yet what are they doing now? They're treating him in such a way. They're blaspheming him. They're treating him with contempt. There are many things that I've shamefully got used to in this sin-filled society, but I pray that I'll never get used to blasphemy. That I'll never get used to Jesus' name being taken in vain. But there'll always be in my heart and in all our hearts a grief at that and a longing for that day when it won't happen anymore. Their words are blasphemous. Their words are empty too, aren't they? Verse 67, they ask, if you are the Christ, tell us. Are they interested? Do they really want to know? Well, turn on to John's Gospel again. Turn to John chapter 10 and verse 24. They've asked the question before. John 10, verse 24. John 10 is that great chapter about Jesus as the good shepherd. And they ask in verse 24, how long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. And what does Jesus reply in verse 25? I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. But you do not believe because you are not of my sheep, as I said to you. So he's told them, he's made it plain. All his miracles are testimony to the fact that he is the Christ. But they won't believe. They won't follow. They won't have him. They will not be his sheep. Indeed, the very next chapter of John, if you're interested in John, chapter 11. What's chapter 11? Chapter 11 is Jesus's one of his most amazing miracles. He raises Lazarus from the dead. He's been in the grave 4 days. It's in many ways one of the ultimate signs of who Jesus is. How do they respond? They want to kill him and re-kill Lazarus. So back in our passage this morning, these words are empty words, aren't they? They're not interested in whether he's the Christ. They've already determined that he's not. He's certainly not the Messiah that they want anyway. And they're only asking it so they can use it to condemn him. That's clear, isn't it, from chapter... Look at verse 2 of chapter 23. They say at the end, one of the things they say, he's saying that he himself is Christ, a king. So they want him to say he's the Christ so that they can say, he's a king, he's trying to be a king. And of course they think Pilate's going to be worried about that. Their words are empty. People do ask empty questions still today, don't they? I mean, some people have genuine questions. Of course they do. Issues that, struggles that they have about God and about life. But there are many people with empty questions. They've already made up their minds about Jesus and about Christianity. And they'll ask you their questions, but they won't listen to your answers. Their words are blasphemous, their words are empty, their words are untrue, aren't they? Look at verse 2. We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. Well, I suppose at least the last part of it is true, isn't it? Although they're trying to twist it. But what outrageous lies, perverting the nation. I mean, this is the man who's taught what? Love your enemies. Turn the other cheek. This is the one who said a sign of true greatness is when you serve other people. And far from saying don't pay taxes to Caesar, when they come and try to get him, again, you young people remember this, don't you? They brought a coin. He asked them to bring a coin. What does he say? Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. It's hardly perverting the nation, is he? Hardly stirring up trouble. Yes, he is a king, but he's made very clear he's not interested in an earthly kingdom. They say in verse 5, he stirs up the people. What does he stir them up to? Love and good works. It's interesting, isn't it, that such things have often been placed at the door of Christians, haven't they? They've been spoken of as if they're a threat to society and the cause of its ills. And that sort of thing is coming again, isn't it, even in our own society? Christians are being spoken of as if we're the haters. We're the intolerant ones. We're the dangerous to our children people. When the truth is, as we seek to follow Jesus, we're called to love and to honesty and to honor those in authority over us. Their words are blasphemous and empty and untrue and telling. Are these Pilate's words now, aren't they? You see, Pilate knows these Jews, doesn't he? He knows what they're doing. He can see through the accusations that they are bringing. He knows that these Jews actually hated the Roman occupation. They would never, in normal circumstances, hand over some patriarch, somebody who's against the Roman authorities. He can see right through it. In fact, Matthew tells us that he knew that they handed him over because of envy. Matthew's gospel tells us that. And what does Pilate say then in verse 4 of our passage? I find no fault in this man. In fact, this is the first of several times that's said, isn't it? If you turn over, well, you may not have to turn over. Verse 14, he says there, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people, and indeed, having examined him in your presence, I find no fault in this man concerning the things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod. Or if you go down to verse 22, he says it again. Why? What evil has he done? I find no reason for death in him. Or actually, after Jesus dies, verse 47, Luke records the centurion saying this, doesn't he? Certainly this was a righteous man. They put to death a righteous man. They put to death an innocent man. There's no fault in him. In fact, it's not just that he's innocent of the crimes he's committed, that they're saying he's committed. He's innocent of any sin, isn't he? He's pure. He's spotless. He's blameless. He's like the lambs in the Old Testament had to be, without blemish. Without blemish. So their words are blasphemous and empty and telling, untrue and telling. Let's think about their aims. Let's just briefly think about that. What are their aims then when it comes to Jesus? Well, the Jews want to kill him, don't they? They're absolutely united in that. It comes out, doesn't it, a number of times in the passage. Then verse 70, they all said, are you then the Son of God? Verse 1 of chapter 23, the whole multitude of them arose and led him. They're just united in this one aim. They want to get rid of Jesus. They want to kill him. They want to get on with their lives. They want to get on with their religion. They want to get on with feeling good about themselves. And Jesus is in the way of that. What about Pilate? Well, Pilate wants to pass the buck, doesn't he? He knows that Jesus is innocent. He knows that. But these people are pestering him. What should he do? I mean, he knows what the right thing to do is, but that might get him into trouble. And so when he hears that he's a Galilean, and he knows that Herod, who was under the Romans, allowed to rule that area, is in town, he thinks, this is a way out. I can pass this on to somebody else. And he sends him to Herod. He sees it as a way to avoid making a decision. Now, of course, it doesn't work out that way in the end, and we're going to have to come back to Pilate next time. But that's his aim, isn't it? Avoid making a decision. And what about Herod? Well, Herod wants to be entertained, doesn't he? That's his aim. He's delighted, in fact, isn't he? You know, did you notice that in our passage? He's delighted. Verse 8, look, when he saw Jesus, he is exceedingly glad. He's desired for a long time to see him. He's heard a lot about Jesus, and he's pleased that he's there. But what is he interested in? What's he hoping for? Well, do you see it there? He's hopes for some miracle to be done by him. He wants to be entertained. He wants to be amused. He wants something spectacular to see. But Jesus isn't about that, is he? He's not interested in entertaining people. He's not interested in just satisfying people's curiosity. And so Herod's disappointed and of course shows his true colors by what he then does, doesn't he? So can I ask you then this morning, if you've fallen asleep, wake up again. Can I ask you this morning, what is your aim when it comes to Jesus Christ? Can I ask you that? Can you all think about that for a moment? What's your aim? Are you trying to get rid of him? Really, in your life, trying to silence him because he keeps coming into you, you keep hearing about him, and keeps making demands of you, and you don't really want that, and you're trying to silence him, just like these Jews were? Is that true of you this morning? Are you pretending to be interested, and yet not really interested at all? Not really willing to have him as your Christ? Are you like Pilate this morning? You know, you just want to just... let's put it off. Let's put it off to next week. Let's put it off to next Christmas, next year, another time. I don't want to make a decision about Jesus now. Is that you this morning? It's a very dangerous game to play. Or are you like Herod? Perhaps you're here this morning to be entertained. You're here to, you know, sing a few hymns and have a bit of a warm feeling about being here. But you're not really willing to bow to Jesus Christ. Have him as your king. What's your aim this morning when it comes to Jesus? What should your aim be? Well, it should be, if you've seen who he is, and if you've understood something of what he's done, your aim should be to bow before him and love him and trust him and give up everything for him and count everything loss compared to him. That should be our aim, shouldn't it? If we're Christians here this morning, no sacrifice should be too great to make for him. No sin should be too precious that we've got to hold on to it. That should be our aim this morning. Well, much more briefly, let's think about Jesus. This is a much briefer second point. Let's ask this, look at the same three things then about Jesus. First of all, his actions. Well, the striking thing is that there aren't really any actions, are there? I mean, he submits to all this. He lets it happen. This cruelty, this mocking. He takes the blows. He wears the robe. Now, don't forget what he'd said to Peter in the garden. Again, you young ones, remember. What did he say to Peter in the garden? Do you not think I could not now pray to my Father and he would send immediately more than 12 legions of angels ready and armed? Don't you think that Jesus could just speak like he did in the garden and they all fall down again? Of course he could. He's not helpless here, is he? So what's happening? He's displaying such patience, isn't he? I mean, sometimes the wonder is what Jesus does. I mean, what a thing it would be to have been there on that day when he calmed the storm or when he raised Lazarus from the dead, and we'd have gone, wow, what an amazing thing he does. But in a sense, it's even more amazing what he doesn't do here. We go, he's just taking it. He's allowing it. And we go, why? Well, because he's just prayed in the garden, hasn't he? If this cup can pass from me, then let it happen, but not my will, but yours. And he knows that it is the Lord's will, isn't it? It is his Father's will. He's drinking the cup. He knows that he must do this. He must endure this. He knows it's the only way to secure our salvation. In Hebrews 12, verse 2, we're told to look to Jesus. You remember, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So he endures it, he patiently bears it, looking, knowing that there's a joy to come. But that verse in Hebrews links us on to what Jesus says, Jesus' words, because that verse in Hebrews 12:2, how does it end? Endured the cross, despising the shame, sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And I want us to just focus for a moment on what Jesus says in verse 69 now, back in our passage. Because in verse 67, in response to their question about whether he's the Christ, he says, well, if I tell you, you won't believe me. And if I ask you some questions, if I ask you a few questions about the Christ, you won't answer me. You certainly won't let me go. You've already made your mind up about me. You've already decided what you're going to do to me. But let me tell you what God's going to do to me. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. In other words, it's like this, isn't it? He's saying, you've made your verdict. You've decided what you're going to do with me, but I can tell you this, God has decided something very different. You're going to bring me down. You're going to take me to the cross, but he's going to lift me up. He's going to sit me at his right hand. That term, Son of Man, he's of course speaking about himself, isn't he? Hereafter, the Son of Man, it was his most frequent way of speaking about himself. And it takes us back to Daniel. You can look at it later on. Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel's given a vision and he sees this, the Ancient of Days seated. And then this one who's like the Son of Man comes to him on the clouds of heaven. And he's given a kingdom and he's given authority and he's given power that will last forever. And Jesus is saying, this is what's about to happen. Yes, I am going to die, but that is going to lead to my exaltation. It's the one leads to the other, doesn't it? So the one who's going to take the place of sinners and be humbled and take the place of Barabbas will be raised and seated. The one who was obedient unto death, even the death of the cross, God has highly exalted him and given him a name above every other name. So what did we sing a little while ago? The head that once was crowned with thorns is crowned with glory now. Let's not forget that. Let's not forget that. As we think about Jesus' words, let's not forget his silence. His silence. I think there are two aspects to it. I put them down there. There's a wonderful submission to see in it. But there is also a solemn judgment as well. There's wonderful submission, isn't there? He's not answering back. He's not defending himself. They're saying these things about him, and then he's just quiet. I mean, we wouldn't be like that, would we? We'd be wanting to defend ourselves and justify ourselves and say a few things about them. But Jesus knows what he's doing here, doesn't he? He knows he's fulfilling Isaiah 53, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. He knows what he's doing, doesn't he? He knows he's the lamb and he must bear this in our place. But there's also a solemn judgment, I think, in this silence as well, particularly the silence with Herod. He has nothing to say to Herod, does he? You see, Herod has had many opportunities before, hasn't he? Again, you younger ones remember what happened. He'd arrested John the Baptist and imprisoned him, hadn't he? At his wife Herodias' request. He'd left his own wife, Herod's, and he'd married his brother Philip's wife. They'd met and become infatuated with each other and run off together. And now they're in a relationship together. And John the Baptist had spoken against that and for his troubles had been arrested. But we know from the other Gospels, again, that Herod feared John. Says in the other Gospels, he knew that he was a holy, just man, and he got him out of prison at times and listened to him. But he never did anything about it. He never listened to those warnings. He never repented, as no doubt John called him to. And then the crunch day came. Again, you young people remember it? The banquet happens. Herodias' daughter dances. The king, in foolishness, says, oh, you can have whatever you like, up to half the kingdom. And with her mother's prompting, she asks for the head of John the Baptist. And the moment's come. And rather than do the right thing to save face, he has John the Baptist beheaded. Though he knew he was a holy, just man. And we think, was that his last opportunity? It's certainly solemn, isn't it, that Jesus has nothing to say to him. And he certainly shows, doesn't he, that he's not repentant by the way that he treats Jesus. He's not repentant for what he's done to John. He's not humbled himself. That's a terrible position to be in, isn't it? I think that would be it is the most terrible position to be in when Jesus has nothing to say to you. When you refuse and you refuse and you refuse, and Jesus has nothing more to say. Does that alarm you this morning? Well, let me say this morning. If it does alarm you, it's a good thing if it alarms you. But here you are this morning, and Jesus is still speaking to you because you can hear his voice now. He's speaking in the gospel. So it's not too late for you. It's not over for anyone here this morning. Still, it's the day of grace. Still, you can come. You may have hardened your heart and refused and put it off and put it off and put it off. But today is still the day of salvation. And this morning you can come to this wonderful Savior. What's his aim? His aim is to seek and save that which was lost. His aim is to drink the cup of God's wrath so that we don't have to drink it. His aim is to give his life a ransom for many. And this morning, he still opens his arms and says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Have you come? Don't be a Herod. Don't harden your heart. Come now while you can, and he'll save you and have mercy upon you. You can just pray to him. Just ask him to have mercy upon you to help you, and he will. Because he doesn't turn anyone away. Well, may God give us a fresh view of Jesus then this morning. Let's sing as we conclude. We're going to sing from the supplement, number 46. In the supplement. I think this is a wonderful hymn about Jesus being on trial and standing in our place. And it captures the wonder and the truths of it so well. Number 46 in the supplement. He stood before the court on trial instead of us. He met its power to hurt, condemned to face the cross. Our king accused of treachery. Our God abused for blasphemy.